bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. I noticed that you and I both, Andrew, are working on our Fletch hat wings. That little—I never knew that that was a thing. But our hair on the sides has grown so long that it's starting to feather on up.
Yeah, two things about that. Well, Justin Robert Young,
no hat wings here for old Paulie Pomade.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
I got the this used to be an undercut, but now it's just a very messy crew cut.
It's just a regular cut.
That's just hair. That's just a regular hair.
Yeah. Yeah. So Fletch Wings, number one fact. Number two, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I moved into my new apartment right as the event started. And I have not found my comb. So I am 2 months now. No comb has touched this hair.
I keep having to record, you know, like ads and interstitials and stuff and Scam Nation episodes, but I haven't gotten a haircut in nearly 2 months. So my hair gets increasingly Trump-like. I notice, especially in the back, where it sort of like swoops up with this little curl,
Brian,
at the back.
It's damn luxurious, I must say.
the
way it is, it is.
It is. No, it looks good.
Running your fingers through there, Brian.
It's one of those things where it's like I'm torn between my impulse to get a haircut as soon as I can, but also realizing that in my lifetime, it will never be more socially acceptable to look this schlubby than it is right now.
No, you need to go full Brad Pitt, kind of like let it kind of the come down kind of thing, and just you know, kind of that.
I feel like there's some kind of like over the hump I could get here.
Oh, right? You could do this. You could do this,
Brad Pitt. Right? Right?
You could actually do
all right,
this.
I'm going to keep on
Brad
going.
Brad Pitt, then. Long hair. For those playing along at home, just Google Brad Pitt, long hair.
Legends and that of the is Fall, our, man.
That, oh, yeah. There you go. Totally pull it off, you know, because you've also got the blonde hair, too. So, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So, welcome to Hair Club for Weird People.
The wings kind of give you a Jim from the Office sort of look.
Well, I feel like it has to go just a little bit farther.
Yeah,
in fact,
inches.
I went back and I started watching like early 80s miniseries and TV show, and Bonnie accused me of only watching it because my hair was starting to feather out like it was the early 80s. And and I'll be damned if I don't look like half of the visitors from V. But so today we actually. Bonnie started to teach me how to feather out my hair in kind of this bozo kind of way. But in fact, there was a character, if you look up Brian from V, I in my fantasies, I would grow up to look like. So I think I'm trying to look like Brian from V.
I just like Brian takes off his hat and it's this swept sort of kind of coif sort of look, though. I take it off and I'm like, it's like behind your desk, all your computer cables.
Yeah.
Damn you, Brian. Damn it.
I regret nothing.
Yeah, I hope there's a lice outbreak in your studio. I'm kidding. Mostly. Hey, gentlemen, really exciting news. Genuinely very cool. NASA announced last week that they have finalists for what is called for the Artemis program. As you know, there's a mandate for NASA to try to put two astronauts on the moon by 2024, which of course is a very ambitious schedule. But the way they decided they were going to try to do it was reach out to private enterprise and to different companies and contractors and say, can you make this happen? So the first round was they had proposals from different companies who came in to say, this is how we want to do this. Normally, what NASA does is they say, hey, we want a rocket that's this tall, uses these engines, it meets these specifications. Oh, look, our favorite contractors already have that. Nobody else bother. We got it covered. And then you end up with the SLS, which, by the way, turns out each engine, which they need five of for the main stage, is now going to cost like $180 million. That's neither here nor there. Point is, for the Artemis program, they reached out and said, hey, we're looking for proposals and we're going to fund them. You have 10 months to take it as far as you can, and then we'll evaluate and then look at the next round of funding. So they announced the winners of this first round. There were three winners that are going to get funding to take it forward. One of them is called the National Team, which is actually Blue Origin and some other contractors, I believe, including Lockheed, where Blue Origin's going to build the Lunar Lander section. Lockheed will build, like, I think, the human section. And then they're going to use, you know, a heavy lift booster. I think they could use a couple different ones. Another company that won a grant, and these are in, like, the hundreds of millions of dollars. Some of them are more, some of them are less, is a company called Dianetics.
Oh.
And we're like, wow, that's ambitious. It turns out that it's a company that's worked, Dianetics, which has worked before with NASA, and they've had a subsidiary called Leidos. They've done a lot of different sort of background projects of NASA stuff that, like, I've never even been aware of. But, you know, you look at all the hardware that goes into things like space launches and, you know, space station, et cetera. So they've got a grant. They won money to try to develop the next stage, and they've got their proposal, which is pretty cool, which is this sort of looks like it's got bunny ears when it lands, you know, and it's got this sort of like two, it's going to have like the human module with these two tanks on either side. So it's kind of slung between them, which is neat. And the third recipient is SpaceX. Well,
hold on, wait. Let's just, because this is an audio only podcast, it is Dianetics, not Dianetics. Like, it is spelled differently than the canonical Scientology tome.
When you hear every person I've heard who's talking about space pronounces it subliminally.
Without a doubt, there's no way you read that and you don't think, is this some Scientology stuff?
Dianetics. Oh yeah.
There we go.
And it will be launching from a volcano. So there is that. So the third recipient is SpaceX, and SpaceX proposed, and this was had been unseen to anybody outside of SpaceX, you know, the fans and stuff of it. They proposed their lunar lander, which they want to take Starship and basically do a version of Starship, which is designed to land on the moon and has a different sort of design to it with solar arrays, et cetera. It doesn't have the reentry fins that the other Starship has, but they plan on trying to propose this. And what's significant about this, it's a very radically different architecture than what's been proposed before. This would be fully reusable. This would be a fully reusable architecture, and the amount of payload that it would bring to the moon surface, the lunar surface, would be 10 times what everybody else can. In fact, there's images where they show this thing next to all the other proposals, and the comment I thought was funny was like, so what's it going to do? Bring them all there too?
Ha! It's like, you know what? We could all be winners. You guys just hop in the back seat and we'll be there. It is wild to look at it and think in terms of, you know, I know it was a big deal during the Apollo 11 landing to make sure that they could find a flat enough area to land on. That becomes even more important in a SpaceX when you're landing a 3 or 4 story building. You know, you want it to be on flat terrain. I got to assume they begin with the ending in mind and they know exactly where they're headed. But I just picture this horrific bummer of a scenario of him landing on tilty land. But I'm sure they've thought of that.
They got radar and stuff and all that. But a problem that had been posed prior to this, and actually I did an interview, thanks to, it was with Brian of Andrew Heaton. We talked to Dr. Robert Zubrin, and he had been critical of SpaceX's Starship being used to land on the moon because the Starship engines are so powerful that as they land, they would create a crater and send so much ejecta up that could cause a problem. And if you look at what SpaceX is proposing for this, go back to the image there, you can see their solution. And that is they have a group of thrusters which are 2/3 of the way up. So it would appear that what they're going to do is they're probably going to do an entry burn, and they're going to probably fire their engines to slow down at a certain altitude. And then when it gets close enough, those might be like their Super Draco thrusters or what have you. And Zubrin had said that, you know, it said that, oh, you know, RCA, the reaction control gas jet thrusters wouldn't be powerful enough on Twitter like 2 days ago. But the Super Dracos they're hypergolic. They use the same sort of fuel that one of the other landers was going to use. So I think they've probably thought this through. But yeah, Brian, to your whole point, though, about like landing on the moon's hard because even if you have a flat surface, you kick up all this debris. Moon dust is extremely gritty. They said that it would work its way even into the astronauts' shoes, which sounds incredible. So these are all things we have to solve.
Yeah, in one of the things I really dug in the Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars trilogy was how It was sort of a running gag that everyone would call it, you know, Martian dust. And they're like, no, they're not dust, they're fines. And then they would talk about just how troublesome fines were, how they would find their way into everything. And it was like a constant issue with everybody. So I would imagine the same thing could happen with moon dust or fines.
So, but it's exciting though. So 2024, what do we think about that date?
You know what, man? If you asked me 4 years ago where this country would be right now, I would be nowhere close to correct. So you ain't even going to get me to make a prediction about 2024.
Who knows? Obviously, stranger things have happened in terms of, government funding of stuff. And if this is a NASA operation, hopefully that continues to move forward. But I do think that considering we do have the cheap space flight, like there are still things that we can learn on the moon. And I think that that would be a sign that we have gotten our exploration to a point where this is possible. I do think that it's certainly worthwhile.
It'll be fun to see. I mean, I hope, you know, it's smart. I think taking the strategy by letting these companies come up with the different approaches towards doing it. And I think in 10 months or whatever, I think that's the number I heard, they're going to then assess. And I've heard that they may actually fund two more projects to go forward from there. So it won't just be one out of three, but two out of three. And I would like to see if SpaceX can do what they're doing. I'd like the idea of that, you know, that be one of the alternates, because it's the most ambitious approach, but it would be great to have, you know, just a really heavy lift capability on the moon.
So. Hell yeah.
You know what else could use some heavy lift? This podcast.
That would be patreon.com/weirdthings. If you head on over to the Weird Things Patreon, well, you're going to find a place where you can go ahead and give us a little bit of coin. Obviously, these are tough times, and we appreciate everybody who has continued past our the first of the month. Everybody who continues to support this, make sure that we come out here each and every Monday and give you a fresh new episode. And if you are a patron, well, you go ahead and get the After Things podcast early. You get a custom RSS feed. Come on. What are you waiting for? Patreon.com/weirdthings.
You know, one of the things I think we may have joked about, like, you know, what it would have been cool to do while, let's say, like, Disneyland and Disney World are abandoned is the idea of, like, I don't know, going there. Well, somebody did it.
Wait, they just hopped a fence?
Some guy hopped a fence or two and made his way to Discovery Island at Walt Disney World, which is this large island, which is in the middle of a lake there, which that at one point was going to be the island that they were going to build, like the Mist theme park that was rumored about. And so some dude decided he was just going to camp out
there. I know
this
island. We stayed at Fort Wilderness last time we were there, and we took the ferry right by it, and we got to gawk at it, and we were told about how it used to be the home of VIP tours and that there was all kind of wild animals up there and all there. That's amazing.
So he spent, it was like a couple days there, and in his defense was like, oh, like I just thought it was tropical paradise. I didn't know it was closed off.
Right. I mean, which, yeah, for those of you who have not been to Walt Disney World, like, there is no mistaking that you are crossing into Walt Disney World property. Like, that is a very expansive piece of land, and nobody around that area doesn't know what they're doing.
It is a smaller island than you would expect. Like, you could probably run around it in maybe 10 or 15 minutes if there is a proper jogging trail. It's really bizarre because you can see it's like half developed. They had some stuff that they clearly had plans and ambitions to do something with, and then it didn't go anywhere. It's one of those things where I just would assume there are cameras everywhere, even if you don't see them.
Well, that's the interesting thing about Disney World, is that where there are cameras, some places there are lots of cameras and stuff on rides and stuff where they worry about people, like, you know, falling into stuff. Other places they aren't, because like on an island like that, you've got to maintain them, you've got to keep control of them, and it's also a thing that they're not really worried necessarily about people doing that. And cameras still to this day kind of require somebody watching them, so you know, it is a very heavily you know monitored facility. But
yeah, we're seeing some footage right now from 2017 of people kind of gawking at the desiccating remains of the island.
Yeah, that's actually, yeah, it's Bright Sun Films, which does a lot of their, like, the Abandoned series, which is pretty cool. So they'll show all these different kind of abandoned theme parks and stuff. So that's a cool place to check. And, I mean, the amount of YouTube channels and content on all things theme parks and Disney now is insane. You know, there was a lot.
Yeah, you want to know what? This kind of just looks like Lost. Like, it just has that, like, overgrown, there was something here. Kind of vibe to it, but that's crazy. And so this is Brian. So it was in between Fort Wilderness and like Magic Kingdom. Or?
Yeah. There's a ferry that you take over and you go right past it. Right before you take over, you take the water bridge over the highway, which is really surreal when you're on a boat and you see cars to your right that go in an underground thing underneath your boat and then come out the other side.
That's funny.
Yeah. One of the fun things to do, too, is if you next time you and your family plan a trip to Walt Disney World, go try the speedboats, the little boats you can drive around.
Yeah.
Really fun. Really, really, really fun. It's one of those things that, you know, you'd see like, I'm going to do that some year. I'm going to do that sometime. And then last time I was at Disney with my girlfriend, I said, you know what, let's actually go do that. And it was such a delight to ride those around because you just get free control. You can ride around and you can see parts of there was the River Country. Do you guys know that was one of the Disney World original parts of the park?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's, you see there was this thing called, like, I think Disney called, look up like River Country, Bryce, I think that's what it's called. And it was back in the 70s, they had this whole kind of like another sort of water park there that was a sort of like long, lazy, like laying the water go around, whatever. And it was right off of that island. The problem was, is like it was like all fresh water and not like the chlorinated water that they use.
That seems like a recipe for disaster.
And apparently was. And so they had a few outbreaks and stuff and things like that. So eventually just stopped doing that. But yeah, we're looking at some video of them now, like, you know, River Country, and looks so much fun and just that fresh, fresh, clean water. None of that, you know, chlorinated water.
Wow. Yeah. It's funny. Even in the commercial, you can kind of just see the water look kind of like green and brackish.
But you know, what's funny is that's exactly the Schlitterbahn in south of Austin is completely fed by the Comal River, and it looks roughly the same as that, but it's all fresh water. And it's actually pretty great.
Well, Brian, you said river.
Yes.
This is a stagnant Florida lake.
Yeah, fair enough.
having grown up there, the canals were fine. You saw a pond. Think twice. Yeah, now we're getting the photo of the bacteria in the lake.
So, I don't trust them. I don't trust ponds. I don't like them. They're up to something. They're plotting. Scheming,
but it's
these ponds.
But it's serious because you're riding along, you know, in your little boat, and you see parts of this thing that are like this totally falling apart, rotting away, whatever. And it's very un-Disney, you know, to see that. So, kind of just fascinating. Here's a cool research paper, and what's interesting about this is that it's more of a hey, here's a thing to think about. Not necessarily we think this is legit, but let's not ignore the possibility. We've talked before about Planet 9, the idea that there could be this, you know, since Pluto got demoted, a ninth planet way at the outer edge of our solar system, something that could be like, you know, 5 to 10 times the size of the Earth, you know, as far as like 500 astronomical units away.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, the assumption is based entirely on stuff not matching our gravitational predictions. Like, it's like, well, it seems like something's causing this all to not line up right.
Yeah, well, if you look at like the Kuiper Belt objects, it's actually like they seem to be pulled towards something. Like there's something that seems to make them, instead of being random or their distribution sort of spread out evenly, there seems to be, what is best explained is our understanding would be some object that's pulling them in one direction. And there could be other explanations. There's been a lot of different, you know, but we keep coming back to like, well, if you saw this, you'd be like, well, there's something out there pulling on it. The problem is it's so hard to see. But this paper says, hey, by Edward Witten, Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, with the wonderful street of Einstein Drive, by the way. Edward Witten suggests, let's consider the idea that there could be a black hole in the outer solar system.
Now, That doesn't seem like the craziest thing on the planet to me, or off the planet, as it were.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I guess black holes are defined just basically by the steepness of their gravity well. I mean, outside of that, they're like any other celestial object. They have a pole, or...
Yeah, they would have, if you had, you know, you could take, you know, your truck and you could collapse that into a black hole, and from 15 feet away, it wouldn't be any more gravitational pull than your truck has, you know. But you start getting super close to it, and then that's when sort of problems arise, and all of a sudden you start touching it, and then all of a sudden it starts, you know. So that's sort of the right way to look at kind of a black hole is the idea is it has as much gravitational pull as the mass that goes into it.
Can you imagine, like, let's say after we become a type 2 or type 3 civilization, like there's like an environmental cleanup. Let's say it is a black hole, and it's like all of a sudden there's space environmentalists that are saying, hey, man, we're about to finish a Dyson sphere. What say we use that energy to move this gravitational object to just let's sweep that black hole out of our system. Because much like you can divert an asteroid, let's say an asteroid's coming to planet Earth, one of the ways to keep it from smashing into Earth is send a gravitational object to just sort of hang out near the asteroid to just sort of steer it off course because it's going to be attracted to the spaceship just like the spaceship is attracted to it. What if we had some kind of massive effort to do that, to just sort of, yeah, no black holes in this system. Get out of here, black holes, get.
But do you see what they, Bryce just had the headline, which said how big it might be.
The size of a baseball. Holy cow. The mass of 5 Earths, the size of a baseball.
Yeah. So, in order to move it, you're going to need something that's, you know, the significant mass to get it to move.
But even then, I guess if it's a 1,000-year project.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no. The scale you're talking about, sure. Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah. I'm just saying it's that's the thing. But think about, that is a crazy thing to think about. That's 5 times more massive than Earth, and it's just the size of a baseball. Like, you know, you're flying through space, and that goes through your hole. Well, you're part of it now.
Batter up.
So and the challenge, of course, is if there is something of that size, how do you spot it? Because you're never going to notice it occluding stars because it's so damn small at that scale. And, you know, you would have to start looking for more and more evidence of
the
interference.
We've talked before about the idea of a larger than a planetary size telescope. The idea that just like the Very Large Array is a bunch of radio telescopes arranged in sort of a triangle, you know, pointed out. And then between all those data points, they're able to get a virtual dish. I don't know, several miles wide. We've talked about a series of satellites that could be orbiting planet Earth that could essentially create a virtual lens the size of bigger than the planet Earth. I could imagine that if you have a detailed enough map of the stars, you wouldn't, as you said, it's very unlikely you would ever see a baseball-sized object occlude a star. But I think you could track the visual distortions of the gravity well, right?
I don't think if it's the size of a baseball, I don't think you're going to get a distortion that's going to be that significant.
The mass of 5 Earths or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's just it. And your occlusion is just, it's not going to be bending light that far out.
I guess the most I can picture, and this, now we're back to like a 1,000-year project. I could see some kind of massive dusting, similar to on a small level, the way we would dust for fingerprints. I could imagine a bunch of nanoparticles with a particular signature being released uniformly, and then you watch the way they turbulence as they distribute with their signature. But again, that's a multi 100-year project, I would guess.
Yeah, the challenge, of course, though, is the further away you get, the more spread out they are. And, I think, but to that point, though, looking at existing objects, Kuiper Belt objects, et cetera, probably would be, because there is a gravity, even though it's the size of baseball, it has the mass of 5 Earths, so you're going to be watching it disturb stuff. So, looking at other objects and just using you could use your telescope array and say, let's start mapping all these things out there, and let's start getting to a granular level and see how things are being disrupted. And you know, you probably could. And then this paper mentions using like laser powered spacecraft like Project Starshot, which is actually out of Dr. Phil Lubin's lab, which would be an interesting way to sort of probe it. So,
yeah, that's one of those things that sounds untenably tedious in human terms, but once we wrap our minds around the scale of tedium that AIs can handle, you know, give an AI 5 years and it will individually map every single thing. I can't remember. One of Edwin Hubble's discoveries was this remarkable star field where out of all these thousands of stars, he noticed that just one had moved just a teeny bit or whatever. Mm-hmm. It might have been the discovery of one of the planets on there. But something that just seems unreal for a human to discover is child's play for an AI.
Yeah, if you get that, that's the, where they would use the whole flashing back and forth between those plates looking for that. And, and once you could start having look at the patterns of a lot of things all at once, then it's really an exciting era to be in. We will see what happens next. But I just, for me, reading about the idea of, there could be, an entire, black hole hanging out the outer edge of our solar system. It's like, cool.
Yeah, I remember when the super collider, or no, it's not a super collider, whatever the thing in Switzerland,
Hadron Collider.
There was talk about like you might make a black hole, and I remember being so confused by the response of but it'll be so small it'll just evaporate, and I'm just like, wait, what? That's not what I think of a black hole doing.
Yeah. Yeah, they've had
it
some
just
pretty
kind of outside. Like it just traces away like a fart.
Yep, it's like oof, that was really embarrassing. That black hole.
Oh, Steve, did you keep black hole in here? Say,
somebody open up the vents. Give us 20 minutes.
Oh.
It's fine.
Right, but it is a good example though of how there is a disconnect, because one of the things I'd say that like I think in science writing, which can be frustrating, one is scientists are very knowledgeable about their domain, but once they speak outside of the domain, you start to realize that often they know just as much as you could just ask your mechanic.
Politics.
And they would have even a physicist answering biology questions, like an astronomer answering questions about aspects of stuff. But I see this where all of a sudden we're like, wow, they know as much as just a person who's kind of smart and follows the sort of stuff, but their expertise is just,
limited,
very narrow. There's the joke about this guy's talking to this man asking what he does. He's like, oh, I study red ants, da da da. I'm entomologist. He goes, oh, cool. About your wife? Oh, she studies, entomology too. Oh, really? What does she? Well, she studies, ants. Oh, really? You guys must have a lot to talk about. He goes, oh, no, she studies black ants. Just totally, totally different. And science writers have to cover a lot of different topics, and you got to seem like you're credible. So when you read a lot of science coverage in newspapers and stuff, we kind of assume they know what they're talking about. But we've talked about this before when Murray Gell-Mann and Michael Crichton were talking about, they realized that they know nothing about what they're doing. And you read a lot of science coverage and you start to get into a topic like, man, they don't know what they're talking about. And my heart goes out to them, because it's like, hey, there's a new research paper today. Break it down and explain it to people.
Right.
It's like, okay.
Also, make it super clickable and make it one of your 6 posts this afternoon. Good luck.
Yeah, exactly. Give us a really, attention grabbing headline, which may misrepresent what's in it.
A weird phenomenon. And it's actually kind of, obviously pretty prescient now, considering that we have a perfect storm of a lot of emerging science, a lot of people that have no time, that have all the time in the world on their hands, that are smart, that are now all trying to process this like coronavirus thing. And it's just, it's hard. It's a full-time job just parsing out what's worth reading and what is actively making you dumber by like the smartest people that you follow and know, like be they of all different stripes. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is frustrating, because, we look for answers and stuff, and then we see that somebody's got an MD in back of their name or whatever, and they're maybe an emergency room physician or like, oh, I'm going to see this. And then you listen to them say something to like, man, this person has no grasp of statistics. And you're like, and I'm concerned and scared because I'm listening to people say completely contradictory things, but they all have the category of expert. And
yeah,
it's, you know,
well, and that's the Murray-Gell-Mann effect as delineated by Michael Crichton, which is we have the ability to say, oh, well, they clearly don't know what they're talking about in this one subsection. Turn page. They must be an expert in this, though. And of course, you know, they're all just doing their best to translate the press, the AP releases.
Yeah, and we all sort of fall back on the way we want the world to be. Like, I know in my Twitter feed, I get two very sort of hot takes on what's going on right now. And it's interesting because I see my ideology likes this interpretation of stuff, so I'm going to give you this. And then the other side, like, well, my ideology likes this interpretation of it, so you're stupid if you don't see this. And
all right. It's like, this is a very rare event in space, in Weird Things history. We've talked about hard science. We've talked about some weird science for one of the rare times, and I think the chat room has it. Spin-12 wants to know, Elon Musk, what was this week? Like, this is somebody who is not Andrew bringing up Elon Musk.
I will give you one short, simple explanation.
Relationships?
His girlfriend, Grimes, is due to give birth today.
Oh, really?
Yes. Elon is waiting. He's in a house with 5 kids and his girlfriend who's about to pop with a kid. That's all you need to know right there.
Humans, am I right?
Yeah. He went on Twitter, and Elon be Elon, okay, and this is, I tell people, like I when Elon says something crazy, I am heavily invested, full disclosure here, and I really feel it because, you know, I can look at that, this is the day at which I never have to work again. You know, 5 more years of working and whatever. Like, I feel it every time he says that.
He's the perpetual Punxsutawney Phil of your life. It's like every time think winter's over, he pops up and sees his shadow.
Yeah, I let me put it this way. Like, when he took that hit on the Joe Rogan show, it probably would have been cheaper for me to have taken the fall for him and paid all the court fines. No, it was me. I did it. You know, I don't care if they had gone, whatever, been prosecuted. Anyway, but point is, I'm going, what the hell is going on? You know, so he made a comment, several things, and then he's obviously very frustrated by the shelter in place, et cetera, because also, like a lot of business owners, you know, when your business is kind of effectively shut down, you're looking at this from a different way than other people are. And then he also talked about, like, hey, I'm going to sell all my stuff. I'm selling all my stuff, all my possessions, all this sort of things. And people are like, what? The stock market's doing great, but he made a comment like, I think Tesla stock's too high.
Okay,
like,
wait, well, which that was the one that raised my eyebrows all the way to the back of my head. Didn't he get slapped for talking about Tesla stock at all? Like, isn't that the red line no-no? Is he's not supposed to talk about whether
or
not—
He can talk about it. They have to go through when he talks about
the
things
board.
Materially. There has to be approval or whatever, but offering an opinion about it, whatever. And also it's going to be, there will be lawsuits, I'm sure. But a CEO who can say, yeah, I think our stock is a little bit is highly priced right now. He can say that. And there's an argument to say that it is, although as a shareholder, I'm like, well, let it be highly priced. And I'm like, well, here's the thing, Elon, keep your mouth shut about that. You don't have to sell all your houses, you know, but he's really not. It comes down to the Mars thing. He's really, really in on this, and he wants to focus full time Tesla sustainable and then just go run with Starship and really build this galactic empire.
Yeah, he's going crazy, though. Right? I mean, I just mean like in the same way that we all are in quarantine. Well, however Elon Musk's brain works and however much it is being pressure cooked by 5 kids and a pregnant pop star girlfriend, I can only imagine that there are there's some wear and tear there, and we are seeing exactly that leaked out on Twitter and apparently during the earnings call, because the earnings call was a little bit of a wackadoodle moment too.
What? And I'm like, I'm like, yeah, welcome to Planet Elon. This is not the first time this has happened when he gets stressed out, where we get, you know, the crazy sort of stuff. And I'm like,
this is ironically one of the more relatable Elon outbursts. People are like, yeah, man, I feel you. I want to do the same thing.
Yeah. I'm just saying that, like, yeah, he was crazy from the start, guys. I'm going to, you know, like, the story I love is I think it's Reid Hoffman, you know, one of the PayPal co-founders, talks about visiting SpaceX and Elon's showing his buddy around and says, over here is the Falcon 9. Now, the next generation, the Starship, is going to be the one that we're going to use to go to Mars and build the colony. And Reid's like, man, I just found the upper limit for ambition.
I mean, yeah. Spoiler alert, still not the upper limit.
Well, but I mean, as far as a realistic person who could say, I'm going to do this, you know, if you know, my buddy from high school tells me I'm going to build a colony on Mars, like, great, good luck with that, buddy. You didn't finish your porch, you know. But when this guy says it, and you're like, wow, this is a realistic thing this guy may actually do. And that's,
oh my gosh, I'm seeing all this stuff from the turn of the month here, where he's just he's losing his mind. He wants to go outside. He's just like, please.
Yep. So
yeah, he was back to talking about Minecraft though last night. So I feel like he's calmed down a bit.
Yeah, I mean, because we don't know like. You know, was there just a fight over what they're going to watch on Netflix and stuff, you know? And then he's like, I'm just going to mess around on Twitter, you know, and, you know, a couple of Jim Beans later, another thing. And it's like, oh, geez. Don't know. Hey, you guys want to do some picks?
Yeah, I got a weird pick for you guys. Weird pick for weird things. Season 2 of the Gimlet podcast series, Conviction. I am currently most of the way through it. I don't know what was in season 1, but season 2 is some fantastic investigative reporting covering the story of the Satanic Panic worldwide. And it starts with where it all began. It begins by sort of calling their shot with a particular case in San Antonio where there's a family, the Quinneys. And you hear audio sound bites of a kid telling this adult kid telling these insane stories about, you know, digging up corpses with his dad and being forced to eat it and all that stuff, and how his dad was a Satanist and everything. And it's very striking. And then it as good investigations do, it takes you back to that time, makes you understand how the Satanic Panic emerged, how it resembles so many other purity spirals, witch hunts, what have you, how it started off as a campaign to believe the children. And there are countless number of children whose lives are better because some psychologists said, hey, it's very unlikely that if your kid says they were touched inappropriately, that they're just making that up out of nowhere. That's not something that kids tend to do. And as a result, a lot of people who would otherwise brush off things being said by kids took them seriously. And there was a lot of actual predators that were caught, and family members who were inappropriately touching kids. But that is a double bind scenario where, of course, if you only believe the kids and if you push against them and then they push back, that means you just have to push harder until they finally admit that they really were victims. And then it talks how that started to lead to false arrests. And there's one particular county in Los Angeles where they had, I want to say, 350 cases that they said where kids had been molested. And it's like they ran out of people to blame. And so families hopped in the car and went camping, which is air quotes for ran away from town because they felt like they were just going to be caught next. Spoiler alert, they were caught next and went to jail falsely. Wow. And then there comes a particular moment that they play audio of what is alleged to be the first seminar that anybody uses the word Satan. And then it kicks it into overdrive. That's when everything goes into fifth gear. And then for the next 7 years, everything's ramps up and up and up, and you get to this insane story. And I am sure everyone on this podcast knows that I have a particular interest, but I will save that part of the story for another day because I don't think we've really talked about it on the air. But it's fascinating. It's a fantastic story. Well represented. They talk about the nature of manufacturing false memories. And when you hear the investigations, the interviews with these kids, it is heartbreaking to hear the kids say, no, that's not what happened. And to hear these adult detectives say like, oof, well, your memory is not as good as Susie's. Susie already said it was like, are you sure? Let's think about that again. And he just keeps on going until finally the kid says, yeah, they touched me here, I guess. I don't know. And it's crazy and heartbreaking, not for the faint of heart, but very, very well done.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating because that was such a scary thing because, you know, we went through, you know, the longest time is, you know, silent victims not being heard, people ignoring a problem with a large scale problem and then addressing the problem. And then, you know, you with a satanic panic, you had the confluence of, you know, the crazy fundamentalist, you know, Christian groups that saw Satan everywhere. And then from, you know, crazy town, this form of therapy that, you know, came from sort of an entirely different sort of, you know, part of the philosophical spectrum that's like, no, children don't lie. And if you talk to them long enough, you get these memories and stuff. And then overzealous cops. And the next thing you know, and it's, you know, when you get that kind of overreaction, then what happens is the group after that, you get more victimization and stuff because people are now afraid to prosecute or do this stuff because of this. It's just scary. Scary.
I mean, I think what's crazy about the satanic panic thing, and I'm so excited that there's a larger exploration of this, is that I wonder if something like that is just an era of or a moment of its own time where, like, if a news story like that happens later as mass media continues to grow, I wonder if exposure of it reveals it to be as flimsy as it is faster. If it was just
I think that no matter how well understood the mechanics of it, I think the terror moves faster than the facts. And I think they had good distribution. Oh,
there's no doubt. Yeah. I think the difference is that like terror lingers if there's no other point of view, right? Terror lingers if there's no outside interaction with it. And that's something that I think fundamentally, if there is a difference between then and now, is that we expect the world to react to everything now in a way that didn't happen before. Things were more provincial.
It's a good question. I think one of the challenging things, though, is that like, we still have this mindset. If the crime is horrific enough, we will then decide, well, then due process, we don't need it. That's the scary thing. We still have that mentality of like, well, this person didn't deserve a trial because of what they've been accused of. And it's like, wait a second. You know, they've been accused of something horrible. And now we're saying they don't deserve a trial. Like, what if they're innocent? Oh, it's too horrible to even offer them a chance. And it's that weird, not under, and you see this a lot in political discussions, all over, whatever, where all of a sudden we want to dispense with due process because, no, this is just too outrageous. We have to do this. And we saw it with, you know.
There's a remarkable story near the, I don't know, two-thirds mark about a guy who got scooped up, both the guy and his wife. She got bail. He did not. In 2.5 years of being in jail, awaiting trial, he gets a plea deal where he's offered only 960 years if he admits that he's guilty, and at which point he will be eligible for parole in 2152 or something like that. And he had been so dialed in watching, you know, kind of where the wind was blowing through his lawyer that he said no. And they came back 3 days later and they're like, okay, 60 years, just admit to this one. And then he said no. And then 3 days later, they came back and they're like, okay, just admit to this one, 3 years. And he's like, no. And then finally they came back and they're all like, all right, just admit to lewd behavior with the minor and you could go home tonight for just time served. And that was the point where he had to call his wife and she's like, you could literally come home tonight and we could put all of this behind us. And so the bummer is, it's like, I understand why he would say, yeah, I'll take the deal. He has to be on a federal, you know, sex offender registry. He did eventually get his kids back and all that stuff, but it's a true miscarriage of justice all the way around. It's amazing.
Well, that's one of the things that often we as public doesn't really so much understand what happens is that, you know, you get accused of a thing, right? And then all of a sudden the prosecutors go to you and say, all right, you know, Brian, you've been accused of running an illegal koala farm on your property. And you're like, it was my neighbor's koala. It walked over here onto my property. Oh, you admit it. You know, like, you know, 50 years. Oh, my gosh. 50 years, Brian. You're going to lose everything. But if you admit to it, you'll only be 5 years. You get out. You go back to podcasting. You can never be near a koala again. But you can do this. And you're like, but I didn't do this. And now you're weighing the thing in your head like, well, yeah, if you fight this, then you're going to spend 50 years. And you're never going to be able to play with koalas again. And this is, they force that, you know, they put the people in that situation where plea, and people will plea, not because necessarily they think that they're guilty. It's just because that risk, that chance that if they fight this, then they say, the prosecutors say they're going to go for the full thing if they lose to a jury trial. And that's the thing we just don't understand so much of what goes into it and why sometimes like 90% of cases end in pleas, you know, like yeah. just never really well, go to the trial
also,
phase.
And also like really weird backdoor bargains. A friend of mine, man, 20 or 30 years ago, bought some technical equipment that he suspected might have been stolen or hot or whatever. So I mean, he was guilty. But then they picked him up for that and they said, hey, you can go to trial on this and possibly face 3, 4, or 5 years or whatever. You could plead guilty and definitely get 2 years. Or also, we got this kind of loose hot checks case floating around. If you plead guilty to that too, it'll only be 1 year and we'll guarantee you minimum security prison. And he's like, wait, so all I have to do is sign this other thing and I get half the sentence? Sure, I did those hot checks. And so I got to imagine that there's a lot of saving face that happens with.
Justin, do you have a pick? Okay.
My pick is Community. I started watching it. It's a good show.
Hot takes. Man, if we're going to talk about hot takes.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's really good.
Spoiler alert for my upcoming review of the premiere of the rest of Rick and Morty last night. I never thought a Rick and Morty episode could be up its own butt and not have it be a visual gag. But it was last night. We'll talk about it on Cord Killers.
I just finished rewatching Community. Or did I even finish it? I might not have finished that. No, I did finish it.
Ugh, I don't think anybody did, including the staff.
In a lot of Community holds up, and then once you get into the couple of seasons where, you know, oh, Dan Harmon's on the outs, Dan Harmon's coming back, the Yahoo stuff. Yeah. You know, the show was kind of pivoted to be, you know, and I think I respect it of trying to be like, we don't want to be the formulaic thing that, you know, got us that really honestly worked very well early on. But I don't know, it just has a little bit of a tinge on the tail end there. But I think a lot of Community holds up really well.
Yeah. You know, Abed and Pierce specifically are just such great, great characters. Like they are written so well, and it is a fascinating look at how Chevy Chase, who is like obviously reviled as we find out yet again, Chevy Chase finds a new generation of cohorts to have make hate him, is kind of played as sort of that character, right? He is this like a toxic old dude that nobody likes, and yet he is still very talented and the writing is great.
It's a show that the further away they got from the Joe McHale's character and the Britta character romance and those, the further away they got from that, the better it was. And I would say that some of the best episodes were pretty spread out. And I think that the period when Dan Harmon wasn't there, I think you could tell the difference, but there were some good episodes there, you know? And I think when he came back, it wasn't like all of a sudden like, ah, the magic's all back now, you know? But that was a show that really surprised me. It was much better than I thought.
Yeah.
So come watch it.
Yeah. I got a pick. This was actually a few weeks ago. Hopefully I didn't mention it on the show already, but I found the Hulu original show Shrill to be a very easy watch. I think they've got 2 seasons out now, and I believe that they're working on a third season. But I think that this was really, really funny. You know, more than anything. I mean, I think it's a, you know, it's a fine concept, but in execution in writing, I think Shrill is a really great show. You know,
what's the elevator pitch?
So Adie Bryant is the lead character. She is a she runs the calendar at a weekly newspaper in Oregon, I think, or Portland or something. And she's kind of a bigger gal, and it's kind of a slice of life story about her, you know, navigating the world in a world where, you know, we still have like weird.
There's baggage about plus size ladies.
Yeah, and so she ends up doing some writing and ends up having kind of being this sort of firebrand writer for this weekly paper, and some of her her interactions there and her love life, trying to figure out, you know, if this friends with benefits relationship with this guy could actually be more than just, you know, hooking up. And I think it's really good. Also, just a couple of really great I think you should leave with Tim Robinson cameos. The Santa delivered us a printer girl. She is a recurring character, and the guy from the porn guy honking following Tim's character.
Yeah,
he's in season 2.
Yeah,
yeah. But it's great, and Shrill on Hulu.
I have two picks because I love you all. My first pick is my friends Jordan Gold and Simon Cornell, along with Max Timken, have put out a new project on Kickstarter, which is called Magic Puzzles. And Simon and Jordan are magicians who also love puzzles. And so what they decided to do was to come up with jigsaw puzzles that, once you put them together, a little bit of magic happens. And that's as much as I can say. And so they've started this cool project. So if you go to Kickstarter and you look up Magic Puzzles, you can see this. They started, it launched today. They're already, you know, blew past their, you know, the funding goal, but just a really, really cool idea. You know, really neat artwork, you know, neat designs, something fun to do. And then the idea that once you finish it, there's a little bit, something else happens.
And they talk a lot,
Magic.
They talk a lot in the Kickstarter, like description of the ways that they try to make it a very, quote unquote, premium jigsaw, right? Like in terms of, you know, the cutting accuracy, or, you know, things like puzzle dust, which I didn't know was a thing, or hand, or like custom doing all of the pieces so that each piece doesn't really cut off too much of the visual imagery, you know, that each piece kind of has its own specific look. I think this looks really, really cool.
As opposed to just random cut.
Yeah. Or cutting into the middle of, you know, contours and stuff.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they put a lot of effort to it. And that, of course, is, you know, Max Timken, who is, you know, got a pretty good track record there. So I think it just, again, I'm very proud of my friends, been working on this for a long time, watching them work on it, watching them finally get this thing released. And it's cheap. You can buy one puzzle for $20. You can get all three for $60. And, you know, if you want something kind of beautiful, fun, and cool, that spend your time doing it, and it'll be rewarded at the end, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. And I just love the artwork and the way it looks. So that is Magic Puzzles on Kickstarter. Now, my other pick, my media pick, also on Hulu. I am loving, I finished, I love Devs. I absolutely love Devs, which was the Alex Garland 8-part series. Alex Garland, previously, he did the movie Ex Machina, wrote and directed it, and then he did Annihilation, which wasn't my favorite Alex Garland thing, but as a writer, he's been around for a long time. He wrote the screenplay for the Dread movie, the cool one, Carl Urban, a lot of other really cool stuff. This one stars Sonoya Mizuno, Nick Offerman, Allison Pill, Jin Ha. I would say that the delivery the characters used is kind of very David Mamet-esque. The premise is, I'm going to say that it's really a philosophical mystery set inside of a techno thriller. And at the beginning, it kind of feels like, well, I know who my techno villain is, and I kind of know where this is going to go. And I'm like, it's going to go way deeper. It's going to go way deeper. So that's Devs, D-E-V-S on Hulu.
Man, that's so wild. I'm really glad to hear that, because I've heard a couple of other recommendations to go see it, but I know that our own Bryce Castillo ended up kind of giving up at the end. It didn't land with you?
No, the opposite.
He hated it. He said it consistently. Devs sucks. No. I'm Bryce Castillo. Devs is bad. It's garbage bad. I hate it. That's a stated fact. Everyone knows this.
What I said is,
F Devs.
There's
Bryce Castillo.
There's a lot of bad stuff in Devs, but the ending saves it, I think.
Period. End of sentence.
I think the beginning is a little tough to get through, and I think the middle is maybe a little watery, but I think the ending and what they end up trying to get to is good. I think there are good ideas there.
I would say that with Alex Garland, that and I hear what you're saying, and I think that I would say he made choices, and I would say those choices were very deliberate, where in other shows, I would say those were not so much choices as just as much, I don't know, whatever, you know, oh, yeah. And where here, there's choices that sometimes I go, that's an artistic thing. I don't know if that's for me, like the delivery and some of the ways it works. But I'm like, I mentioned, like to me, it's kind of like a very David Mamet-esque way in the way some of these things work, where it's deliberate. This is the way he's going to do it. And on the surface, it looks like every other crappy techno thriller with a techno villain. If you just watch the trailer, it looks artistic and stuff. You'd be inclined to think like, oh, I get it. There's a big mystery. Wonder who did it. Da, 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 da. And it's like, nope, a bigger thing going on there and a philosophical thing. And so I really, really enjoyed it. And, I had somebody on Twitter's like, well, I didn't agree with this. I'm like, I don't agree with that. But I love the way it was presented. You know, I love Garland kind of, and I also like, I think, you know, that the problem was like, I don't think you understood what he actually said, not to say, aha, but it was like, Alex Garland, like an ex-Machina, he wanted to get into the idea of artificial intelligence and go very, very deep on that. And I loved, you've all seen Ex Machina?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And it was like, I just like, there's a couple things in there. I'm like, well, that's sort of, you didn't need, that's sort of silly, but it was beautifully done and a wonderful, like, you know, so much better than stuff like, I haven't seen where Westworld's gone, and I think Westworld is a pretty show. I think Westworld has a really kind of neat approach towards stuff, but I think Westworld to me doesn't go, it pretends to go deep, but it doesn't really go deep, you know, and it sort of feels more like Lost to me than, you know, an artist, you know, writer, director saying, I'm going to explore this. I'm going to show you what I think about this, and you can disagree with me, but let me just take it as far as I can. So
yeah, I would agree with that comparison for Westworld. I mean, we've been talking about it on Spoiler Time, but I think it was last week I said, like, hey, Westworld's very dumb this season.
Yeah.
It's kind of dumb.
Very pretty, very...
very pretty.
Like,
very...
I can't... we were talking about how somehow the sum is less than all the parts.
Yes.
Like, every single part of Westworld is exquisite, and yet all put together, I care about it less than ever.
It's only during after the episode, like, behind-the-scenes things where they're talking, like, this episode, we want to question, like, humanity, and are humans actually... are robots humans more robot than humans?
Oh, yeah, I guess you kind of did that.
Okay. You should have said that.
I haven't seen season three, and again,
it's beautiful.
I like everybody, and I like everybody involved. It's one of those, like, I'm a fan of everybody involved in the show. You know, Jonathan Nolan, you know, Lisa Joy. All I like everybody's great, and I don't know what happens when you're talking to HBO and the executives and what we want. And so, I'm not blaming anybody. I will tell you the moment that really. Season one, the thing frustrated me, spoiler alert, was like, they're the same guy, even though one's 1 foot taller than the other and all that. Dun, dun, dun. I'm like, okay, that's a long way to go for a narrative trick that doesn't really help the story to me, but that's fine. I know you got to do this. And then it was like season two, like, we're recording everybody in their hats. We use the hats. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's like a Matrix battery thing. I'm like, this.
Funny you should mention really the Matrix.
Funny. Oh, yeah. And the hat stuff doesn't go away.
Yeah,
hey, guess what? They love that hat tag.
If you love the Matrixiness and the hat trickery, then boy, are you going to love season three of Westworld.
Season three is the hat trick.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen anything, but they kind of, season two was about building a Matrix. So it's kind of like, well, I think I know where we're going to go here. So,
yeah.
I'm just making an assumptions there. I have no idea. But anyhow.
Did they ever go back to Westworld? Is there horses in the show anymore? Or
they do
no
it once.
They
do once in season three.
Yeah. But they do go to like, oh my gosh, we're in such beautiful country. Other person. Yeah. This is the place that Westworld was based on. But we're not in Westworld. It just looks exactly like the ranch where we shot Westworld.
We're just riding these horses through Mexico.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So there are horses.
Yes.
Because it didn't look like there was a lot of horses in the commercials, so I haven't watched it yet. Because I'm mostly here for the horses.
I'll tell you what, man. It's probably a worthy watch while you're playing Hearthstone. I mean, it's just everything is it's beautiful. Set design, everyone's good
actor.
You
need to really... Brian, you need to definitely start qualifying all of your reviews as to whether or not you're watching them with your undivided attention or whether or not it's a Hearthstone watch.
It doesn't
have to be like a negative thing, but just as a qualifier.
I think that's become a standard habit, and Westworld, to qualify, I have given my full attention to, for good or for ill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've been in, and I'll talk about next. I'll talk about Picard, which I'm almost done with, which I've been enjoying it. But occasionally the phone comes out, you know, I'm like, oh, these characters are talking, phone comes out, da-da-da-da-da, you know. But that surprised me. I've enjoyed that way more than I thought. I'll talk next week. So, cool. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.